This is Polling Matters. My name is Kieran Pedley. Welcome back to part two of our special edition on Scotland, where I've been talking to Rob Vance and Professor John Curtis from the University of Strathclyde. In part one, we discussed the independence referendum and the polling around that, and also the current position of the SNP as we approach the general election in May. In part two, we'll be talking about Jim Murphy's position, what the challenges that he faces and maybe how he might look to meet them, and we'll also talk about what might happen in the general election, both in Scotland and in Westminster. I started the second half of the podcast asking Rob just what he thought the Labour strategy should be as they look to take on the challenge that is the SNP.
Well, I think from a strategic point of view, there's actually some trade-offs there for Labour. I think that I'm not necessarily advocating this as a brilliant strategy, but I think some of the things that I think John's point about making the election meaningful and matter to the people of Scotland might well be at odds with what the Labour Party's strategy south of the border is. And in this day and age, we saw his announcement about the way in which he would, as a leader of the Scottish Labour Party, use money that was raised from, the mansion tax, and how that would be using the wealth of millionaires in the southeast to fund nurses in Glasgow. That you can imagine very quickly that some of the most easy tactical wins for Jim Murphy in Scotland could well play very, very badly in the south. And let's face it, if faced with the prospect of winning over the magic swing voters of the south and taking gaining a seat and the Tories losing a seat, being far more valuable than actually losing one single seat to the SNP, particularly given the SNP's position. So I think we should take a step back in terms of what the actual incentives and some of the constraints are in terms of Jim Murphy. Obviously, Jim Murphy personally is going to be judged by how many seats he can take, but the Labour Party nationally is going to be much more judged by the total seat share, which might well be actually improved by a different kind of strategy, which in this day and age, very, very hard to deploy two very, very distinctive strategies north and south of the border. But I think in terms of making the election matter, the key thing is going to be turnout. I believe that the Holyrood election was around the 50% mark. We had the referendum being at the 83% mark, I think I'm right. 84, 85. And Westminster last time being somewhere between the two. In terms of mobilising people, historically south of the border, Labour's vote has tended to be much more, as it were, soluble. A high turnout election definitely benefiting Labour. It may or may not be the case that that's true in Scotland in terms of who the vote is. It's very different. So, if the SNP can mobilise all those people to go to the polls, who, as John says, frankly, maybe don't care so much about the Westminster election, that might be more of a challenge for them. Maybe it'll be easier for Labour to turn out its base. I'm not an expert in terms of where the sort of the relative strengths are in the safest and weakest seats, but I think the ability to do a good turnout operation on election day could well be really, really critical.
Well, one thing to say about the turnout is, again, the referendum has left a legacy. I mean, one has to remember the turnout in the referendum was the highest turnout in a nationwide ballot in Scotland since the advent of the mass franchise at the end of the First World War. All of the evidence of the polling is that when you ask people on a scale from 1 to 10 how likely you are to vote, something at least like 10% more people in Scotland say they are certain to vote in the Westminster election than is true across the UK as a whole. And to that extent, at least, if that apparent continued enthusiasm and interest there, which is obviously manifested by the dramatic troubling of the size of the SNP membership, is maintained, and I think we can anticipate that although we won't be up the 80-45% of the referendum, that the turnout in Scotland will be markedly higher. And to that extent, at least, I'm not clear that that's going to be particularly helpful to Labour. I mean, because the opinion polls are, frankly, reflecting this continued wish on the S side to affirm a faith and a belief in the cause of independence.
I mean, let's do that thing that we should probably not do, which is get our crystal balls out. To coin a phrase, we all know there's so many different variables of the general election all over the UK. I mean, we talk about UKIP, we talk about this green surge, we've got what's going to happen in marginals, Labour and the Conservatives, how is the Dem incumbency going to play out, that sort of thing. But thinking specifically about Scotland for a moment, just how well do we think the SNP can do in terms of vote share and seats? Because one of the things, John, you've alluded to is that actually there is this threshold, isn't there? There is this kind of best case scenario, maybe, that Labour can squeeze the vote, that perhaps the SNP still gets more votes, but Labour can hold on to lots of its seats. So, I mean, where do you see it going? Or do you think it's just too up in the air to be able to tell?
Well, I think the honest truth is, you've got from the tone of my remarks, that I suspect the SNP are going to do what people south of the border would regard remarkably well, but that north of the border where there will be a sense of deja vu. And you have to remember again, crucial thing here is that in the referendum, the unionist vote was united. In the election, the unionist vote is divided between two parties and another party, the Democrats, that's kind of trying to scramble to maintain its existence. The yes vote is largely behind one party. 45% of the vote loses you a referendum. 45% of the vote enables you to win the vast majority of seats in Scotland. And we should remember, if this happens on the day after polling day and Scotland looks as though it's SNP territory, it won't necessarily be. It will be more or less that roughly the same people who voted yes in September would have voted for the SNP in May, but that in a referendum 45% you lose. In a first-past-the-post election in a multi-party system, 45% you go
crucified.
And the truth is, in part, the unionist parties may well end up being crucified by the electoral system that they defend, and the SNP will profit from an electoral system that they don't believe in. But then paradoxes in politics are often part of its joy. Unfortunately, very often political parties fail to understand where their own actual electoral interests lie.
And Rob, this obviously takes us onto the Westminster situation. I mean, what do we think the SNP do in this? I mean, they're probably going to do very well. They're going to have a larger body of seats than they already do, aren't they? So, I mean, how do you see Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon sort of dealing with this post-election? I mean, do you think there's room for a formal coalition with the SNP and Labour, for example? And they've said they won't back the Tories. So, I mean, how do you see that all playing out?
I personally can't see a formal coalition. I think the sort of the West Lothian question and the SNP's view of not taking votes on matters that are devolved and so on just would make that extremely difficult to work. I can imagine some form of confidence and supply. I would imagine, I think they've said very specifically that Trident would be a red line. And so that kind of thing would be, I think would those kind of issues, which actually the British electorate haven't really been discussing Trident for a long, long time. The Labour Party resolved its opposition on this matter in the mid-80s, but it's interesting, you've already started hearing rumblings this week of some of the old CND people in the Labour Party thinking this is a rather wonderful thing to get that conversation going again. So I think those kind of things could come to the fore. Obviously, there'll be demands that are made of further devolved powers and making sure that those things happen, which are things which I imagine a Labour or indeed probably a Tory administration would actually be able to go along with, and seems to be the consensus now. But I think the real question is whether or not they would get another referendum question, or what kind of timing would be given for that, and what would be considered reasonable by the rest of the electorate. So yeah, I don't see formal coalition happening, but certainly there are some clear demands which they're likely to make.
We'll finish on
which will be hard for some people to swallow. I think
this is a crucial point. I mean, we could well end up with a parliament in which, contrary to the assumptions that we have long made about home parliaments, the Liberal Democrats will not be the third largest party in terms of seats. It could be the SNP, together with, we should remember here crucially, the Applied and Green Allies, because these three parties have agreed to negotiate jointly in a home parliament situation. However, the demands that they are wanting to make, not to do specifically with Scotland, but more broadly, particularly on the issue of Trident, but also more broadly this year, they kind of say, well, we want an end to austerity. These are, I think, going to be quite difficult for Labour to accept, even as part of a supply idea. So the truth is that although the SNP may be numerically stronger, if, in fact, we are in a situation where, although they have fewer seats, maybe the Liberal Democrats could still take Labour across the 3-2-6 mark, although even that deal will be one which will require a considerable number of Labour politicians to hold their noses very tightly, will end up being acceptable because it will be easier to deal with, because the truth is the Liberal Democrats at least have positioned themselves on how to handle the deficit quite neatly between the Conservatives and Labour and can move in either direction. Fascinating issue is whether or not the Democrats will be wanting to press for PR for English local government, and whether or not Labour MPs Ned Miliband will be willing to sell his local government base down the water in order to defend his own skin. Don't underestimate that possibility. And that certainly, again, may be easier to have some change to English local government than further devolution of Scotland, because I think the truth is a lot of people would argue, if you look at the kind of international comparative evidence in terms of what Smith is proposing in terms of the proportion of spending and the proportion of revenue that is now would now be the responsibility of the devolved Scottish Parliament, it is at the high end of international comparisons, and to that extent at least it is not entirely clear that within the framework of a unitary state there is an awful lot further to go. Now, that said, of course, one fascinating development in the last recent weeks, and again on which you can see Labour trying to make some hay, is the decline in the price of oil. A decline which, of course, makes the economics of independence look a little less attractive at the moment, but also actually makes the finances of a devolution max, where all taxation will come to Scotland, also look a little less attractive. Now, whether that, in this situation, would cause the SNP perhaps to demand a little less. I mean, on the referendum, I think that's not on the table for what... The SNP have accepted that, however well they do in May 2015, they don't see this as an avenue to get another referendum, and I think there's an appreciation that they wouldn't get a referendum out of any party. They have to decide what to do, what they're going to do for May 2016. They're keeping their powder dry. But again, I think what they almost undoubtedly will realise is that whereas... back in May 2011, the Westminster government felt that they had the moral right to hold a referendum. Given the result, given the promise, I suspect there will be a reluctance to go down that path again, and that, to that extent at least, there certainly would not be a referendum that was authorised by the Westminster Parliament by passing the powers across to Scotland.
I guess to finish, if we take the sort of Westminster view of the general election, it sounds to me, from what I'm hearing, that actually this assumption that there is some kind of easy to form centre-left coalition between Labour, Liberal Democrats and the Nationalists may not actually be as easy to form as we might think, regardless almost of the maths, whether that would produce a comfortable working majority or not. So does that mean that actually these people that suggest there could be more than one general election this year, or certainly within a short space of time, does that mean that that idea actually has some credence?
No, it doesn't, because people do tend to forget the implications of the Fixed Terms Parliament Act. It will be very difficult to engineer another election. And the truth is, once you work through the logic of the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, the only way that you can have another election is if the opposition wants to have another election and agree with the government to have one. That actually, arguably now the opposition has more control over the possibility of an election than the government does. Mm. And that certainly there is no prospect of a government being able to form a minority government and then going off and saying, well, we now want an election. Because even if that government were to resign under the terms of the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, that doesn't trigger an election. There is no way the Queen can call an election. The election can only be called if a government resigns, if at the end of the day the opposition accepts that the government's resigned and that no government can be formed, and therefore there should be an election. So the answer to you is no. And indeed, you know, as a consequence of Fixed Term Parliament, forming a minority government is essentially entering the lion's den and giving your opponents the key to the cage. Very difficult position to be in, and it does undoubtedly increase the incentives towards having a coalition. But the truth is, much as was the case in 2010, neither the Conservatives nor the Labour Party want to talk about this, even though, of course, we now know that actually in 2010, the Conservatives, at least, were extraordinarily well prepared for the eventuality. And I think one of the fascinating things about the referendum, about the election, which, you know, Scotland adds the pressure to, is actually will, over the next 100 days or so, eventually the Tories and the Labour Party be forced to talk about what they would do in a home parliament in a way that certainly all the minority parties, the SNP, the Liberal Democrats, UKIP, Greens and Uncle Tom Copley and all, are actually doing so.
So, Rob, I mean, to close, often it's fashionable in general election campaigns to say this is a, you know, vital election, this is, you know, once in a generation vote. Actually, it sounds like if a fixed term parliament means that, a second election this year or another election quite soon isn't actually likely or possible, then the result of in May is going to be really important to the future of this country in the next 5 years, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm always sort of slightly amused by the idea. Every election is the most important election
absolutely,
in a generation,
yeah.
Of course. But I think, you know, I think John makes an absolutely spot on point in terms of the likelihood of another election. The idea that both Labour and the Tories, which fundamentally what would be required, would both have an incentive in having another election, I think is extremely unlikely. yes, it does make it important, but I think the important thing, and what the polling sometimes obscures as much as it clarifies, is the way in which multi-party contests actually work out at a seat-by-seat level. You know, there are, it's very, very, very difficult, you know, to be able to actually model what the impacts are. And so the impact of Labour on different doorsteps saying this is the most important election, don't even consider voting Green or don't even consider voting UKIP, because we all know this is the time to fight the Tories. The impact of those in differential ways across different bits, particularly in those marginal seats in the South East and the Pennine Corridor, is really, really hard to read. Yeah, it is an absolutely vital election, but what that maps to in terms of the doorstep and the conversations that you're having is, you know, very, very difficult.
So one-word answers for both of you. I mean, well, a couple of word answers for both of you, I guess. Who do we think is going to be Prime Minister in June or July, or don't we know, John?
Well, the honest truth is we don't know. I mean, at the moment, Ed Miliband is still the narrow favourite, but he's only the narrow favourite. But I think the truth is that all of us who've been watching this story during this Parliament are just, and knowing also the history of what tends to happen as an election approaches, is will eventually there just be enough of a movement to the Tories, or perhaps just enough error in the opinion polls, that the means that the Tories edge ahead. The problem they face is that so far the economic recovery has been largely a voteless one, not least, I think, because that vote that they've lost to UKIP is a pretty economically pessimistic vote. But maybe eventually it will come good to them. I think that said, however, I think given the way the electoral system operates, it's going to be very difficult indeed for the Tories to make sufficient progress to get an overall majority. And that does therefore mean that even if the Tories are the largest party, whether or not they end up being able to form another government is itself won't necessarily automatically follow. It will depend on the arithmetic, it will depend on what the deal they can do with the Democrats, and it frankly will also depend on the mood of their own backbenches.
Sure. Rob, what do you think?
I think I agree with that. I mean, I think Ed Miliband is still just about ahead. I think a coalition government that will be very, very difficult. I think it will be stormy times. In fact, you know, I wouldn't be that surprised if Ed started off the Parliament being the Prime Minister but didn't end it as Prime Minister.
Plenty to think about. Thank you both. That was Polling Matters. The music you're hearing is by Kirk Pearson, called Pollinate, licensed under Creative Commons. Leah will be very proud of me that I remembered that. I want to thank our guests today, Rob Vance and also John Curtis. Really interesting discussion. Thank you, everybody.